This is SG2 Perspectives, a conversation with industry experts and SG2 thought leaders about the biggest trends in healthcare and what we all expect that's going to mean for the future of healthcare delivery.
Some of these things we were trying to put in place for years of how to scale telehealth, but for the very first time, we had every clinical department or every supporting department, this became the priority. I've never been in any type of situation where everyone you talk to had the exact same priority. There were no competing priorities.
Welcome to SG2 Perspectives. I'm your host, Trevor Drin. Today, we have an awesome guest. We have Chris Pagano, who leads our virtual health work, and he and I will interview Sean Valenta, who's the administrator from MUSC's virtual health program. So Sean, I'm just going to jump right in. Let's start with some background. Pre-COVID, give us an overview of how virtual health was connected to and really a critical part of MUSC's overall strategy.
Thank you, Trevor and Chris, for having me on. Telehealth's been a big part of MUSC's strategy and history for a while. MUSC started doing telehealth well over a decade ago, as early as 2005. But it was really around 2013 that MUSC had about a dozen telehealth services at different levels of maturity where South Carolina started to invest in telehealth in our state. And they did it through MUSC. We're a state entity. We had a lot of expertise in telehealth at the time. And they kind of gave us a charge of a couple of things. One, they wanted us to create a statewide collaborative, bringing people together, making sure that we were creating a telehealth network that was compatible. And two, that we were charged to develop telehealth services to meet the needs of our communities. I became the first director of telehealth at MUSC. Our CEO, Dr. Pat Cawley at the time, really charged me and our executive medical director for telehealth, Dr. Jimmy McGallagher, to any clinical service that we deliver inside our walls, that we should be able to deliver outside of our walls. And so there really became this push for enterprise adoption of telehealth. And that's resulted from the dozen programs we had in 2013 to close to 100 telehealth services in operations now. And simultaneously, we had a couple of big things that went in different directions. One, we created the South Carolina Telehealth Alliance, which became that state collaborative. So we have great partnerships with people from across the state. That resulted in the American Telemedicine Association awarding the SCTA the Presence Award for Healthcare Transformation last year. Really good validation of the collaborations going on in our state. And then HRSA also designated MUSC Center for Telehealth, one of two national telehealth centers of excellence, really because of our breadth and depth in telehealth service development. So it's been a lot of work over the last so many years, a lot of people contributing to that efforts, but we've had the foundation infrastructure and the leadership with a vision of saying this is going to be a key part of how we're going to reach our patients in the future.
Sean, that's a helpful foundation and background. So then fast forward to 2020. Starting in February, you knew virtual health could be essential during what looked like a potential pandemic coming to the U.S. And I think a lot of the tech infrastructure was already there, but I'm sure you needed to make improvements. So how did you prepare the operational elements, the tech, the workforce, the internal processes, et cetera, to allow you to be prepared when the system really needed to crank up virtual visits?
One of the first things we saw early was we're going to need an ability to screen patients and refer them in some type of large scale way. We already had a direct-to-consumer platform where we were reaching patients over the last couple of years, but we knew we were preparing for March and April that was going to likely receive significantly more patient volume through that platform. We did a couple of things, and we did it through a process that we had been maturing over the last 3 years, something we call TSIM, the Telehealth Service Implementation Model. And what that TSIM is really just a guiding framework on how to create, develop, implement, and sustain telehealth services in a structured way to make sure you're not missing any steps. So typically, we're developing services over a couple-month period. We had a couple weeks that we knew we had to spin something up quickly. So our initial strategy on that was, and the strategy is the first phase of TSIM, of knowing that we need these statewide screenings for referral to a drive-through testing that we were also simultaneously setting up at MUSC. So MUSC was actually the first on the East Coast to set up drive-through testing, and we were the first in the country to set up this virtual assessment coordinated with the drive-through testing component. The second phase of TSIM is the development phase, and that's when you're really diving into all the different elements of the build. So we knew we had a platform that we've been using for virtual urgent care. And we wanted to modify that platform, that technology, to be able to screen patients that were high risk for the coronavirus. Using CDC guidelines and those recommendations, we modified our upper respiratory infection protocol that was already in the platform and modified it with those different questions. At that time, early in the pandemic, it was things about international travel, positive exposure to a COVID-19 patients. And of course, as everyone knows, the recommendations then continued to change weekly and oftentimes daily. And then from that too, we had to make sure that we had a staffing pool that was ready to be able to take on this capacity. So our platform one had the ability to do asynchronous chat, video, and phone. And we knew that using that asynchronous kind of adaptive interview to screen patients was the most effective way to be able to take on this large volume. But from getting the provider standpoint ready, you know, we had 8 to 10 providers trained on the platform, and we knew we needed to multiply that by like 8 to 10. So within a week, we went through a rapid session of that development phase of TSIM, of making sure all of our existing advanced practice providers were credentialed and privileged to do telehealth in MUSC. We made sure that we modified scope of practice agreements, that everything that they were going to do fell in line with the State Medical Board for South Carolina. We also worked with university and practice plan where some of these APPs were hired. We've got the hospital, we've got the practice plan, we've got the university. We had to work with them on a compensation model and payment mechanisms to be able to make sure that once we set this up, we'd be able to pay them. Then we moved into the implementation phase of TSIM and through the training process. And we put a call out early in March of this plan, how it was packaged, what we were going to do, on a late Friday. And by that following Tuesday, we had over 120 MUSC APPs who were working in different departments sign up and say, hey, I'm here to help. It was just a cool thing to see and experience. And within less than a 2-week period, we had over 100 APPs, new APPs, trained on the platform, credentialed, and everything, and set and ready to go.
Sean, this is Chris. The reality is a lot of AMCs historically have struggled, right, with their ability to move rapidly and to innovate and to be nimble. And yet you were able to do that, right? When the chips were down, you were able to respond. I'm curious to know how you were able to accomplish that across so many different departments, really being able to align those services and get the job done in a timeline that was actually going to allow you to be able to respond to the COVID crisis.
It was like a miracle to us because some of these things that we were trying to put in place for, you know, 6-9 months, we were trying to put in place for years of how to scale telehealth. But for the very first time, we had every clinical department or every supporting department, this became the priority. I've never been in any type of situation where everyone you talk to had the exact same priority. There were no competing priorities. We had people that were coming to us, how can I help? And part of me was like, you ain't returned my emails for a couple of months now. And you know, and it was fantastic to be able to see that type of response. It's extremely impressive to see what MUSC as an organization can do when we all have the same priority and we're all working the same direction. I mean, it was miraculous. And we just passed 1,000 visits on that platform in September. We were doing a couple thousand in January, February. We saw over 30,000 patients come through in March. I mean, our president, Dr. David Cole, stood next to our governor, McMaster, early in March. And our governor said, MUSC.care, go here. We will screen you. We will make sure that appropriate people are tested. We were prepared for that, and we were able to handle that.
So you have this historic strategic buy-in, which of course was invaluable as you knew you had to really rapidly ramp up and pivot in late winter, early spring, prepared for a shutdown. How is virtual part of reopen and restart strategy?
It's been a couple of things. So one of our, I would say, initial big efforts early was around in the ambulatory space. When a lot of ambulatory visits were being impacted across the country early in the pandemic, MUSC had one of the hardest hits anywhere because we closed one of our big ambulatory sites that we had just opened up a couple months before. Our worst week, we dropped about 70% of our baseline volumes in ambulatory visits. And prior to that, we didn't have a really dedicated telehealth strategy in the ambulatory area because there was no reimbursement for that. But over the next couple of weeks, our senior leadership, our CEO is pushing everything's going virtual as much as we possibly can. And there was so many physician leaders. We stood up an ambulatory telehealth steering committee, a lot of collaboration between the ambulatory side, information solutions, telehealth, RevCycle, all those different groups came together to really push ambulatory telehealth. The Commonwealth Fund has been putting out, you know, a lot of good efforts in regards to ambulatory and how that was impacted. They showed that on average throughout the nation, organizations were able to get 14% of their baseline volumes flip virtual at the height of this early round, you know, kind of March, April area. MUSC was able to get up to 44%, so more than triple that. So baseline, we're talking about 21,000 ambulatory visits a week. Almost half of that was flip virtual. And while things started to shift backwards more towards in-person, we want to make sure that we're not dropping back on those ambulatory telehealth visits. In addition to that, there's other areas that were impacted when you look at emergency services. So a lot of patients were going into the emergency room. We saw drops in telestroke. We saw our ER capacity really opening up and patients, I guess, afraid to come in to those areas. So we've been working with emergency medicine, both on the adult and pediatric side of things, of what other telehealth things can we do to provide outreach. Those are some of the efforts we're working on now, becoming definitely a component of their plans to respond in new and different ways.
One thing that we've been hearing a lot about is, and as in-person visit volumes have come back to some degree, those virtual visit volumes have decreased, but really in a way that has been highly variable, right? There are some organizations who have been able to maintain those volumes, others who have seen very precipitous drops. I'm curious to know how you're really trying to drive those virtual visit volumes to ensure that virtual health footprint is sustained.
You are going to see some variability, whether it's state by state or different things like that. We weren't able to do these things in the past because, I mean, we could, but we weren't going to get paid for it. And so early in the pandemic, whether it was at the federal level at CMS or state Medicaid or private payers, they started to open up kind of interim rules and regulations to be able to pay for these services. Our biggest private payer, Blue Cross Blue Shield, had an extension that went into August 1st. As of recently, for paying for ambulatory telehealth visits at full 100% parity. They just extended that within the last day to October 1st. So it's one, it's working with the payers. Two, it's continuing to work with the providers in the provider experience, making sure that we're optimizing that. As you can imagine, when you stand up something extremely quick and rapidly, you're not able to do the typical 101 handholding that we would have done in the past in telehealth. I mean, you're talking about training thousands of providers in a short period of time. But once that stood up, how do we go back and optimize that? And we've done a lot in regards to surveys with our providers and understanding, you know, improvements that need to be made, whether it's the process or the technology, and we continue to address those. And then, of course, most importantly, working with our patients and understanding, you know, we've done a lot of patient experience surveys early in the pandemic with the ambulatory telehealth and learning from that and learning key elements that we can understand of if we focus on these things, this is what patients want. This is what improves their experience.
That's absolutely outstanding. Have there been any specific clinical areas where you've seen particularly strong adoption?
Yeah, I mean, for some of the ones you would expect, you know, psychiatry, they've been performing well over 100% of baseline visits. So they've been able to actually see more patients than they typically would. The neurology department in MUSC is still predominantly doing most of their visits virtually. Now, of course, we've had a great partnership with them for over a decade now in regards to being telestroke leaders. I mean, we have a telestroke network. It's 32 hospitals and growing. It'll be probably close to 40 over the next year. They do teleneurology. There's a lot of things that they've been working on. So that provider experience and comfort level was already there. And primary care, a lot of them, family medicine, they definitely stepped up to be able to see their patients. Now, on the other end of the spectrum, of course, you're going to see some of the more procedural-based specialties that really struggle to kind of find their niche of being able to see patients in this way. And that makes sense, right? I mean, it wasn't unique to MUSC. That's something you can see nationally. But there is still opportunity, whether it's pre-procedural follow-up, there is opportunity to use telehealth. And we try to optimize that as much as possible.
You serve a very diverse community, right, with urban centers, but there are definitely very rural areas, right, across your geography as well. How have you gone about trying to overcome that divide, as well as the fact that, again, there's often a huge gap in terms of availability of hardware, right, smartphones and laptops, or again, the lack thereof? How have you kind of thought through that to ensure that there is relatively consistent access to virtual health services, regardless of either geography or socioeconomic means?
to give an example, we have a pretty robust diabetic remote patient monitoring program. They're typically monitoring up to 1,000 patients at any given time. Early when they first started years ago, they had technology issues with patients being able to kind of upload their daily glucose and be able to monitor effectively. They didn't have devices. They didn't have different things. As things have matured, one, the technology has improved. And in certain areas, you know, we are providing devices to be able to connect, you know, with your provider. And so that may be remote patient monitoring devices on a temporary basis because you just had a procedure. So you're going to have something for 30 to 60 days. Or maybe it's something more chronic condition like diabetic remote patient monitoring where you're going to have a device for at least a year or longer. And then also even from video clients, there's a lot of improvement in regards to lower bandwidth settings or technologies to be able to get into lower bandwidth settings that we've looked at and procured over the last couple of years to really be able to help reach our patients in a more efficient, effective way.
That's really helpful detail, Sean. So in the last few weeks in Charleston in particular, we've seen a resurge, no question about it. And the numbers aren't continuing to climb right now. They're still high and scary. So how have you adopted or adapted any of this to trying to handle and shift what you're doing during this resurge?
Right now is definitely from a height standpoint, South Carolina and even, you know, locally here at Charleston, it's been our most challenging time during the pandemic. And I don't know if this is our second wave or really just the first wave, because the initial part was a blip compared to what we're experiencing right now. I would say from a telehealth standpoint specifically, we have all the infrastructure in place and everything was already set up. So we are well positioned to reach our patients. We have a remote patient monitoring program that is monitoring COVID 19 positive patients in their home. If they're not sick enough, they don't need to be in a hospital, but we still want to be able to monitor them in case their condition worsens and to be able to get them into a medical facility safely if needed, to be able to monitor their symptoms. We had that infrastructure set up and we're continuing to do that. We're just seeing more patients.
Say more about that monitoring. Is that kind of clients independently putting in their clients, customers, consumers, people putting in their information? What kind of monitoring is happening and how do you know when something spikes and you need to see a provider?
We internally built it here at MUSC. So we have a team led by Dr. Les Leonard. He's our chief research officer, just a brilliant mind. He used to head informatics at the CDC. His team built this tool that we're using through our electronic health record. It's a PRO, patient reportable outcome tool, where patients can report on their symptoms daily. And we have nurses that monitor that information in kind of dashboard format and has the ability to intervene when we're seeing patients, maybe their status is declining, their increased shortness of breath. And we've had then some patients that we've had to make sure that we get safely transported to a facility before it gets really worse. You know, so we have the ability to say, hey, listen, your status is declining. You need to get some in-person help. But I would say anecdotally, one of the biggest things is some of the patient testimonials that we've seen come through. They were told to quarantine. They're maybe self-isolate. Maybe they already live by themselves and now they're really alone because they can't go anywhere. We're seeing a lot of testimonials where patients were saying, I felt alone until Cheryl, the nurse, called me. Or Eric kept forcing me saying, I need to eat. And I think Eric saved my life because he told me I need to eat more. It's just simple things like that, that they felt they weren't alone because they had this connection. They knew that somebody was looking over them. And if anything was going to go wrong, someone was going to make sure that they were taken care of. People like to focus on the technology of telehealth. One of our models is always think technology last. It's typically it's about the patient and the clinical workflows of how to reach that patient. We've seen a lot of that just play out throughout the pandemic.
Sean, that's such an interesting point. I love your motto there about kind of think technology last. I think that's wonderful. We talk a lot about that as well in terms of starting out with some sort of a care redesign effort or other type of programmatic approach and then layering the technology where it makes sense, right? So I'm curious to know for you, what have been some of those types of adjustments, whether it's redesigning workflows, as you kind of mentioned there, starting to think through redesigning care delivery overall in certain circumstances, and even as you're thinking past COVID, right, and you're thinking towards the future, what are some of the redesign elements that you think are going to be necessary to actually be able to leverage technology in a different way?
Let me take that in two ways. One, kind of the short term, and then the second, more the long-term view on it. So short term, one of the things that we did early in regards to a little bit of the redesign was something that, you know, we kind of repurposed some technology that we had internal to our hospital. We can call CVM, continuous virtual monitoring. Kind of a easy way of looking at that was kind of this telesitter look viewpoint. So we started this program internally at MUSC to initially reduce falls in our hospital and also reduce the expenses of kind of the one-on-one sitter. And we've been doing this almost 2 years now, and it's been an extremely successful service of reducing personnel cost. Early in the pandemic, we repurposed some of that technology and used it in rooms for our patients that were COVID-19 positive and in even rule outs of those patients. And our goal around that was minimizing healthcare worker exposure. And so we used that technology. And so that kind of redesigned some of the workflow, putting this kind of one touch technology platform to be able to do two-way audio video into a room. Our nurses can hit a button, ask questions, and it reduced the times that those doctors, nurses, respiratory therapists had to go in and out of those rooms. So one, minimizing the exposure to our personnel. Two, also preserving PPE that everyone knows early in the pandemic was an issue, making sure that there was adequate PPE for our healthcare workers. And I mean, we were seeing about 1,000 or so of those interactions every couple of weeks. So significant cost savings, but also, like I said, preserving that PPE.
So I'm thinking of different types of things like artificial intelligence and virtual reality, augmented reality, at-home testing kits. How does that actually accelerate the vision that you're putting forward there? And how are you thinking about that today at MUSC?
I mentioned Dr. Les Leonard, his shop earlier in regards to the RPM solution. They've also worked with us in the virtual urgent care space in regards to using artificial intelligence, natural word processing, machine learning, where we were able to see the assessments that were coming in through our virtual urgent care platform, pulling out that information and running it through their analytics and everything else. And we were able to actually identify things early in the pandemic that are now people know that become obvious. An example is loss of taste and smell. That was not a question within our platform, but patients were writing that in the comments during the adaptive interview. And we were able to see the patients that were writing those words in those comments were at a very high correlation with testing positive for COVID-19. And so that was something that we were able to see early. So I think things like artificial intelligence and machine learning, those elements will be there to support clinical strategies and initiatives in a way to just advance them way further than we can do in any type of traditional method.
Sean, thank you so much for sharing your experience and MUSC's experience and your patients' experience. Good luck getting through, like you said, whether this is the surge or the resurge, we don't know, but good luck with whatever comes next. And thanks so much for joining SG2 Perspectives to share your perspective and your background. Thanks to all our listeners. Please subscribe or follow if you want to hear more. I always recommend another Vizient podcast, The Modern Practice. It's on Vizient's Medical Leadership Channel and provides a clinical perspective into current issues affecting healthcare today. Thanks so much.
This has been another great episode of SG2 Perspectives, where industry experts and SG2 thought leaders explore the drivers of tomorrow's healthcare strategies to inform today's decision makers. Contact us anytime by sending an email to sg2perspectives@sg2.com. We'd love to hear from you. SG2 revolutionized healthcare demand forecasting with the Impact of Change forecast, and today we're the industry's premier strategy advisory firm. To learn more, visit sg2.com. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you again soon.